Glenn Hauser speaking with Continent of Media 0602, to be known later as World of Radio Extra 66. Continent of Media is made possible by Universal Radio for quality amateur and shortwave equipment. For a catalog, phone them at 1-800-431-3939 or check their website, www.universal-radio.com. Universal also sponsors www.dxing.com, where you'll find much more information, including the latest edition of this program. Com is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave. Let us begin with a topic which could impact shortwave, power line communications, also known as broadband via power line. On the WTFDA list, Mike Bugage in Connecticut says, I was reading on Harry Helm's Future of Radio blog that the ARRL is optimistic about BPL deployment using the 30 to 50 megahertz band. I suppose that might be as good a place as anywhere to put it. There's not very much there anymore to DX, except some TV channels overseas in the 48 to 49 megahertz area. But there are still a bunch of fire frequencies at 30 megahertz and some police around 42 and electric utilities around 46. I'm wondering if BPL would interfere with somebody's ability to respond to a fire call. Would it cause interference with his scanner at home? In other words, is the 30 to 50 megahertz band finished? A reply comes from Peter Baskind, Germantown, Tennessee. This is a complex question there. There are two, actually. First, whether low VHF is a good place for the technology, and second, whether BPL is to survive at all. It simply comes down to where else are you going to put it? Initially, it was going to be an HF thing, but after a handful of rollouts, primarily hams and others, had become major pains in the butt to purveyors of BPL. As licensed operators, we have the right, yes, the right, to be uninterfered with, and we knew it. Despite promises to the contrary, BPL on HF frequencies did cause hams noise, big time, and the scenario often went the same. The rollout came, complaints followed, climaxing with a formal petition for shutdown. None of those petitions were ever ruled on, as the operators, wishing to avoid bad precedent, turned it off voluntarily, claiming that the experimental period was over. Yeah, right. Sure, the FCC has been unwilling or impotent for the most part to protect hams, but the purveyors of BPL knew two things. Part 15 rules are clear, despite the smoke and mirrors, and somebody will eventually take it to federal court, where the FCC would be off its home turf. Lawyers and hams, that's a big problem. By the way, the writer is a lawyer and a ham. His call N4LI, and the initials after his name, JD and LLM. Peter Baskin continues. So, better not to tick off the hams if possible. VHF low, which is largely unused now, is much easier to work around. Just notch that little which is being used less and less every day. As to BPL generally, I am dubious whether it's ever going to be a big thing nationally, despite the square peg and round hole issue of sending RF through an unbalanced, unshielded power line, which essentially becomes an antenna. Commercial pressures will limit BPL's expansion and may kill it altogether. Most communities now have two or three conduits for broadband, and more are coming on. BPL is just the newest addition, and costs as much or more, usually much more, to turn on. And, where tried, BPL purveyors have been underwhelmed with a response. And to maintain a system, a nightmare. Bucks talk louder than any of us can. So, don't expect BPL to be a big issue, at least not right now. But one thing's for sure, BPL better stay the heck off the ham bands in Memphis. I know where federal court is, and I have a license to annoy. Somewhat later, at the end of 05, this press release from ARRL came to us via John Norfolk. The ARRL is viewing cautiously the recent announcement of a commercial broadband over power line deployment by the largest electric power utility in Texas. TXU Electric Delivery and BPL manufacturer Current Communications Group have partnered to establish the nation's first broadband-enabled smart grid, as they call it. It'll cover most of TXU's service area, including some 2 megahomes and businesses in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and other communities. ARRL CEO David Sumner, K1ZZ, commented, if TXU is going to install a BPL system, ARRL is glad that it has chosen Current's system, which avoids using spectrum allocated to the amateur radio service, in preference to one that has proven to be problematic. It was another story altogether when TXU operated a pilot BPL project in Irving, Texas, in 2004 and early 2005, using different hardware, Amperions. That system generated such interference on ham radio frequencies that the league filed a formal complaint with the FCC in support of a Texas radio ham seeking the system's shutdown and fines for the operator. Within 2 weeks of the league's filing, TXU dismantled the BPL trial and ARRL withdrew its complaint. While Sumner won't rule out some occurrences of RF interference in the TXU rollout, he says the league anticipates a low enough probability to deal with it on a case-by-case basis. The ARRL petition said it is no longer the case that all BPL systems inherently radiate high levels of RF energy on amateur allocations on overhead medium-voltage power lines. Thus, not all BPL architectures have similar potential for harmful interference to the amateur radio service and to other licensed services. I must point out, of course, that we shortwave listeners have no standing at all in this, since we are not licensed, and what we listen to is not protected. On the ABDX list, there was a thread started by Alan First in Round Rock, Texas, about WLW, Cincinnati 700, and leading in to Blaw Knox Towers. He said, the cooling pond at WLW boiled even during the dead of winter. I believe there was a 1927 water-cooled Western Electric transmitter that drove the full 500-kilowatt operation. It was essentially a two-story transmitter with a cooling room in the basement. A huge door would automatically lock when the transmitter was online to prevent someone from accidentally entering the cooling room during operation. The station audio was heard loud and clear when standing at the base of the diamond-shaped Blaw Knox Tower. That's B-L-A-W-K-N-O-X. There are only a couple of towers like it in the country. WSM has one, visible from the interstate. The chief engineer lived in a house on the transmitter site in what was at one time the WSAI transmitter building. Crosley owned both stations during the 40s, and they operated AM-TV and shortwave from Crosley Square. The studios were large enough that separate live orchestra programs could perform on WLW, WSAI, shortwave, and mutual network at the same time. WLW was, of course, the nation's station, and WSAI programmed to the local Cincinnati audience. WLW billing peaked at $11 million in 1949, an astronomical sum for the time, and didn't hit that again until the 90s. It was about $7 million when I programmed there in the mid-80s. Today it's probably in the 20 to 25 mega range. Randy Michaels, formerly VP of Operations at WLW and later president of Clear Channel, did a video tour of the transmitter about 20 years ago. It is available from Art Volo in Detroit. It gives you a great idea of the transmitter's girth. He does radio and audio and video air checks. That's V-U-O-L-O. The WLW signal is truly amazing. It was not uncommon to hear from someone in California and another in New York listening on the same night. This was in the mid-80s, before additional stations were assigned to 700. WLW is also heard in Europe and Australia. Coverage is probably chopped up now, since several stations have nighttime authority on that frequency. The story goes that the 500 kilowatts is put on air during various times in the 40s to signal troop movements in Europe during World War II. There's a book now out of print, which I believe is titled The WLW Story. It chronicles the radio and TV station through the years Avco owned them. Today, WLW is one of several clear-channeled-owned stations in Cincinnati. Now the follow-ups about some other stations which have Blaw Knox Towers. WFEA 1370 in Manchester, New Hampshire. The tower is visible from Route 3, the Everett Turnpike and Manchester Airport, says Bruce Conte in Nashua. It's located on Route 3 at the Merrimack-Bedford town line, and he has photos of it at his website called BAMLog, members.aol.com/amxmtrs/xwfea.htm. Scott Fibish in Rochester adds, also WBT in Charlotte, North Carolina has three towers, Blawnox, WBNS Columbus, Ohio, one, that's part of a three-tower array, and KSTN in Stockton, California has one tiny little Blawnox, that's part of a three-tower array. Within recent memory, WADO in New York had one, since replaced with a conventional self-supporter. I've heard rumors that baby Blawnoxes, similar to KSTN's, exist at KJUG in Tulare, California, possibly at KBKO in Bakersfield, but I've not been there to check them out in person. And finally, Terry Kruger in Clearwater, Florida adds, you may recall my musings in DX Listening Digest about the Blawnox Twin Towers on the Gandy Causeway span, virtually in Tampa Bay between Tampa and St. Petersburg, built in the early 1950s. The towers are still used by WDAE 620. They are scheduled to be replaced with new towers in the coming months. This item from the Media Network blog in mid-November. Continental Electronics announced today it is ahead of schedule in delivering 132 ultra-low-noise transmitters to U.S. government contractor BAE Systems to use in the High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, HAARP, near Gakona, Alaska. When the massive planar array for ionospheric research is completed in 2007, it'll include a total of 180 Continental 10-kilowatt D616G transmitters. The company is upgrading specifically for HAARP. HAARP first installed Continental transmitters in 1993 when the project began. The U.S. government is constructing the HAARP facility to conduct upper atmospheric and solar terrestrial research via a phased array transmitter. With an aim of learning more about the ionosphere, the upper section of the Earth's atmosphere ionized by solar radiation with natural electrical currents that can be modulated with powerful radio signals. Much of the ionosphere's scientific potential lies in satellite communications, which depends on signals passing through it. The final expansion will bring the HAARP array to full power with its effective radiated power increasing from 84 to about 96 dBW. It'll have greater transmitter modulation capability, variable frequency range, and beam steering than any other high-frequency transmitting system in the world. Continental Electronics is under contract to supply 6 transmitters per month. The transmitters for HAARP needed to have extremely low noise characteristics to maximize the ability to manipulate the ionosphere. They also must be tough enough to perform reliably in the challenging Alaskan environment. The HAARP homepage is www.haarp.alaska.edu. This story does not go into it, but you can research it if you like. Among the conspiratorially minded, HAARP may have some much less benign purposes. And at the very least, manipulating the ionosphere could affect shortwave reception. We are in the midst of COM Continent Media 0602. Our address, P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK, 73702 USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. Much more at our website, worldofradio.com. As I record, in late February, there were reports of a possible additional strike against the CBC, or I should say against its French counterpart, Société Radio-Canada. Lise Leroux, head of the union, which was subjected to a lockout lasting several weeks last summer, wrote about that situation in the Christian Science Monitor, parts of which follow, thanks to Jim Motes for sending it on to us. Lessons from a Strike Will Help the CBC. It was published November 14th. Canadians experienced a historic event this summer when their national public broadcaster was effectively silenced from mid-August to mid-October after managers locked out 5,500 on-air production, technical, and administrative employees. The lockout was a tactic aimed at weakening the employees' union and extracting deep concessions that would have allowed the hiring of most new employees on temporary contracts. CBC management framed the denial of service to the Canadian public as collateral damage in the war for a much more flexible, agile, and nimble corporation. It turned out to be a hard sell and one that loyal CBC audiences were unwilling to accept. They lamented the absence of their public broadcaster during the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, during the removal of Israeli settlers from Palestinian territories, and during the return of their parliament after the summer break. They missed the everyday connection that CBC programming provides to their communities, their country, and their world. So they signed petitions and wrote letters to the president of the CBC, Prime Minister Paul Martin, and members of parliament to demand the return of the CBC. At the same time, locked-out CBC workers in all parts of the country responded to their circumstances with creativity and commitment to their calling. They organized public events, produced alternative broadcasts and podcasts, and developed websites, blogs, and advertisements. In innovative ways, CBC workers maintained everyday contact with each other and the Canadian public. After nearly two decades of budget and program cuts, the lockout of 2005 could have dealt a death blow to CBC. Instead, the lockout unleashed an outpouring of support for independent and high-quality programming that is free of commercial constraints. There was such an outcry against the actions by senior management that the team at the top was called before the parliamentary committee responsible for the CBC at the end of October and condemned by members of all four political parties. CBC senior managers wrongly assumed that no one would care when they turned off programming during the low-ratings summer season. Employees and CBC audiences managed to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. They showed that they had more imagination and commitment when it comes to public broadcasting than the CBC's current stewards. The lockout ended without CBC management winning the major concession it sought. Employees held firm on the principle that a permanent workforce, where ongoing jobs are performed by ongoing employees, is the way to ensure high-quality public broadcasting. For that to happen, the federal government will have to stop pretending that its arm's-length relationship with the CBC justifies malignant neglect of Canada's largest public cultural institution. The words of Lise Laroe, president of the Canadian Media Guild. What has become of Ted Koppel? This story from AP television writer David Bauder, published January 4th. Thanks to Lou Joseph's Media Network blog. Ted Koppel and others joined Discovery. Less than 2 months after leaving Nightline, Ted Koppel agreed to a 3-year deal to make documentaries for the Discovery Channel, bringing 9 of his former ABC News producers with him. He agreed to do at least 6 programs a year for Discovery, expected the first to come in late summer or fall. It was a coup for the basic cable network, primetime home of American Chopper, and many hours of programming on sharks. Especially since Koppel and his executive producer Tom Bedag had been talking to HBO about a production deal. Koppel said it was a more comfortable fit at Discovery, given that HBO was essentially an entertainment network. Discovery also offered more immediate access to airtime if his team wanted to respond to a story like the West Virginia mining disaster by producing a special on mine safety. Koppel won't have a news organization behind him like ABC, but Discovery chief Billy Campbell noted that Discovery distributes BBC America, and Koppel would have access to the BBC's material if necessary. Bedag said Koppel's team plans to continue the old Nightline tradition of exploring topics, crime and punishment, race relations, and international news that have few outlets at other TV news organizations. With 250 shows a year at ABC, only about 5% were truly great, Koppel said. Our challenge here at Discovery is to do nothing but the great shows. Will we succeed? I don't know, but that is our goal. Koppel said he did not talk to CNN, Fox News, or MSNBC about a job because he couldn't see any of them, like the broadcast networks, agreeing to set aside a night of primetime programming for a documentary and town hall-style meeting on a topic. The cable news network seemed preoccupied with a desperate race to be first with the obvious, he said, and pay more attention to what is recent rather than what is important. CNN does some solid documentaries, but they tend to bury them, said Koppel, whose daughter, Andrea, is a CNN correspondent. I wonder if she knows that her name is really masculine. Discovery is available in more than 900 million of the nation's 110 million television homes. When it became clear Discovery had a chance to land Koppel, Campbell said we pursued them as hard as we could. And I should add that there have been other reports that Ted Koppel is also signed to do commentaries on National Public Radio. Although I have not yet heard him, and I recently did a search of the NPR website, coming up with nothing so far from Ted Koppel. Here's an article about cable a la carte. To supporters, it is an idea long overdue in the era of HDTV, the prospect of 500 station cable or satellite menus, and the continued synergy of media like television, the internet, and even our phones. Cable a la carte, allowing cable TV subscribers to order and pay for only the channels they want, is becoming all the rage. The FCC has been taking the initiative to promote the new pricing plan. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin told the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee the agency would release a detailed report concluding that offering viewers their choice of TV programs a la carte would be economically feasible. That contradicts a previous FCC analysis under the tenure of then-Chairman Michael Powell, cautioning that a la carte and tier models, like so-called family-friendly categories, would boost already high cable prices. Cable providers have argued that bundling a variety of different channels makes sense financially and gives consumers more variety when they turn on their TVs. The industry has also maintained that the a la carte option is a billing and technological nightmare that would result in higher prices for consumers. Nearly everybody seems to love the idea of a la carte pricing. However, the feds are praising the scheme as representing the ultimate in consumer choice. Messages on blogs, discussion groups, and other forums seem to endorse the plan. Why pay for the Golf Channel or Food Network if you don't watch their programs? And what about the barrage of religious programming? How do you feel about having to subsidize networks which carry the 700 Club or round-the-clock content from Trinity Broadcasting? There are disturbing indications, though, that the a la carte programming scheme, regardless of how it may play out in respect to cost to customers, is not so much about choice as an attempt to narrow the scope of programming coming into homes and part of a wider campaign to eliminate sexual and other controversial content. Many of the organizations singing the praise of the new pricing system have long histories of protesting indecent, salacious, or violent content, not just on TV, but in movies, radio, and even video games. Along with a complex rating system and parental controls, religious groups and others preaching family values see the new pricing arrangement as a crucial step in a broader campaign to ban such material altogether. The American Family Association, Citizens for Community Values, and other groups have worked to restrict voluntary adult access by encouraging heightened FCC policing of public airwaves, and even trying to prevent private hotel chains from offering adult entertainment on their room menus. A la carte pricing could well backfire on those social and religious conservatives who have embarked on a huge PR campaign in Congress and are presenting the plan as a way to rein in raunchy television. The stark fact is that in the entertainment marketplace, even with channel bundling, where cable companies offer packages of somewhat diverse programming, adult content is a much preferred choice. When all pay-per-view entertainment in the U.S. is considered, sexually charged programs, anything from softcore to racier adult movies, comes in second, well ahead of concerts and sporting events. Only first-run movies attract a wider audience. The new plan, which could offer a family tier of stations, including blocks with religious programming, may well filter out much more than provocative adult content. Would PBS and the Discovery Channel, which air documentaries on subjects like evolution, would they get the axe along with anything with a hint of multiculturalism? Would family content be weighted in favor of religious programming, tame commentary shows, and bland reruns? And what about those tens of millions of households that might not want the family tier and go instead with Showtime, HBO, Spice, and more adult-oriented fare? It is doubtful that the religious conservatives cheering on the a la carte pricing structure will simply abandon their efforts to sanitize the content offered by cable, satellite, and internet providers. If the religious right were to bully hotels and other lodging venues from offering their customers voluntary adult fare on the room movie menu as any indication, a la carte may not be about choice, but a backdoor to government censorship. You may be surprised where this came from, the American Atheist Newsletter of December 28th. From the Media Network blog, January 4th, Savvis chosen to stream IBB broadcasts over the Internet. SAVVIS Incorporated, a leading global IT infrastructure and utility services provider, announced that the International Broadcasting Bureau has awarded All Native Systems, Inc., ANS, and Savvis Federal Systems, Inc., SFS, a contract to stream and cache IBB broadcasts, including VOA, worldwide over the Internet using Savvis Global Content Delivery Network, or CDN. Under terms of the four-year contract, valued at up to $2.45 megadollars, the team will provide caching, live and on-demand streaming, and storage for all properties owned by the IBB, including VOA, Radio Free Europe, Radio Marti. The Internet has become a critical means for accessing VOA broadcasts, both in and outside the U.S., said Gary Hosford, contracting officer, IBB. The ANS Savvis team offered us a proven performance record, technical approach, and a unique streaming and caching platform that includes its intelligent traffic management, which answers our specific and growing worldwide needs. Well, I'm surprised he even mentioned the fact that VOA could be accessed inside the U.S. Then Lou Josephs posted this response on the Media Network blog. Bad move. Savvis has the worst network in the known world. The latency level is always bad enough, though it's a local hop. This company doesn't have a CDN. Listeners to VOA and IBB streams won't like this. This company did not have any federal contracts until this one. All Native Systems sounds like a systems integrator, and I'll bet they are from Alaska or Oklahoma and owned by either an Eskimo or Native American tribe. This is going to be an uphill battle, kind of like building a shortwave station over a large vein of iron. The American Indian tribe, the Winnebagoes, own the company. If you Google them up, he added later, they are in Nebraska. And on his own blog, also called Media Network, Lou Joseph added this. VOA and the IBB have signed a contract with one of the worst Internet providers on the planet, Savvis. I have two servers hosted at a site in Seattle that runs on Savvis pipe, and I can't reach them to upload content because the latency is too high. Savvis is the company out of St. Louis that had the CEO who owed American Express several thousand dollars for a night with the young ladies at Scores in New York City, a gentleman's club. Is everyone in D.C. on the take? It seems like it, says Lou Josephs. Those are his opinions, not mine. Standard disclaimer. Glenn Hauser now concluding another Continent of Media, number 0602. Hope you found it interesting. And remember, this program will later be known as World of Radio Extra 66.